Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers. It's me again, dealing this week with one of these myths that will not go away. It's one of these stories in history that will not go away. But fortunately, one of the people who will not go away also is Professor Phil Nash from Penn State, back again to help us walk through this myth, understand it. Professor, how are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm lingering like a bad odor.
Well, it's good that you come back week after week after week, and we do these recordings, and of course, we call them Nashcasts within the Buzzkill Institute because of the
I'm going to be copywriting that, by the way. You watch it.
The numbers are so high, and the reason the numbers are high is because Professor Nash, of course, explains these things so well to us. Now, this is one of the things, not only that needs a lot of explanation, but to me, growing up in the United States and seeing a lot of this, is one of the most upsetting things about the way American history has developed in the 20th century.
That's right.
It is the Lost Cause myth. What is it?
The Lost Cause. Yeah, by the way, the title, in a way, is not a great title because it doesn't really fully, not that one title could, but it doesn't really capture the reality. What it means, it refers to the cause of the South during the Civil War.
During the South, yeah.
But the idea that it's the Lost Cause, in other words, it's meant to connote sort of romance and maybe even the romance of loss or the romance of defeat.
Right.
And to create a certain wistfulness.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, captured in things like Gone with the Wind, by the way, in that very title. In other words, you had this sort of way of life that was actually great, and now it's gone, and how sad is that?
Right.
So, but the Lost Cause myth, and if you look it up, different people will define it differently. Their list of aspects of the myth will vary, but I've boiled it down to what I think are the basic sort of tenets of the Lost Cause.
Okay.
First, and in some ways foremost, would be sort of the glorification of the antebellum South. In other words, the pre-Civil War South.
All right. So this is the Gone with the Wind.
The Gone with the Wind. In other words, you paint a picture of the South with its big plantations neatly kept and the weeping willows and the southern bells and sort of the gentleman planter or gentleman mm-hmm. plantation owner who's very honorable and chivalrous. And, you know, and this you see all over the place. You know, when you know, for example, young people might have a southern-themed ball or something,
right?
And people would dress up. Often, what they're basing their concept and the dress on is this idea of the sort of the Lost Cause South before the Civil War, being this sort of nice, peaceful, prosperous, honorable place.
Mm-hmm.
The second tenet would be that, in case you're wondering, you're like, well, gee, how do the plantation people make their money?
Yeah.
The second tenet would be that slavery is a benign or even positive institution, and that part of this would be that what's called the myth of the happy slave.
Oh, yeah.
Which you don't see so much today for obvious reasons, but for a long, long time, well into the 20th century, in things like songs and movies, you would see slaves depicted as happy or contented. And certainly loyal. That's sort of that's a trope all its own. So the loyal slave, the master who, the slave who is sad that his master has gone away to war, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you have, or some of these, there's a song, I think it's called Carry Me Back to Old Virginny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about some slave who's no longer on the plantation and actually yearns for the good old days of being on the plantation.
Right.
So
if
that
people
would,
said that, you know, apart from being a legal slave, they were actually treated pretty well, and their life
right.
was pretty good.
And you, unfortunately, it's a very tiny minority of idiots, but you can still find people today who will say things like, well, at least slaves had sort of food and shelter provided to them.
Yeah.
Until, you know, emancipation, when they were cut loose, which is such an ignorant and offensive way of looking at slavery, I can't even begin to describe it.
Mm.
But in any case, so slavery is a benign or positive institution. People like Robert E. Lee believed this. Robert E. Lee believed that slavery was worse for white people than it was for the slaves. He believed that slavery was basically a way in which you spread civilization to backward Africans.
Oh, so it was,
and he was not alone in that belief.
It was a burden for him.
Absolutely right. We're doing the dirty work. It degrades white people, but it's necessary. It may be unpleasant in some ways, but it's necessary for black people to civilize them.
Oh, so when Robert E. Lee thought about the northern factory owner, he thought, God, they've got no responsibility.
Exactly.
We've got this huge moral responsibility.
Absolutely right. Yeah, that's the way to look at it. Third tenet would be, speaking of which, demonization of the North.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the North, as of circa 1860, was this place dominated by soulless capitalism and greed.
Yeah.
Wage slavery.
Yes,
in other
right.
words, that free white people, because there's no slavery there, they in effect become the slaves. And because you're a racist or a white supremacist, you believe that that's an abomination, that white people become wage slaves. By the way, in some ways, northern factory workers were wage slaves.
Right.
But that doesn't make slavery okay, and it doesn't make the southern cows okay.
Which means that the wage slave, by the way, Buzzkillers, means that wages in the north are so low that you have to become a factory worker where you're paid so little that you might as well be living like a slave.
Right, and you're locked into it.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, that you have no choice but to be the sort of a cog in a machine, which in early capitalism workers kind of were in mm-hmm. the United States and Great Britain and elsewhere.
And by the way, I lived in a border state in my earlier days, in a border state, and you know, you heard this sort of crap in the 70s and the early 80s.
Oh, yeah.
1970s. You know, it's not just something that happened after the war.
Yeah. You'd have to do a rigorous study, but you could still find people who believe this.
What I mean, particularly the benign slavery and
right.
the demonization of the North.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And that, you know, look at it this way. The phrase Southern honor, that's a thing. People
right.
will refer to that. You'll never hear a phrase Northern honor.
No.
Why is that? That partly stems from this. In other words, the idea that even in the antebellum South, even if it had some rough edges, it was basically an honorable place. Whereas the North is just basically this ruthless Darwinian striving after more money.
Right.
Which, parenthetically, I have to laugh. Because the idea that a plantation owner in 1860 is not somehow a ruthless profit maximizer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? That this is not part of capitalism somehow. This is a charity that they're running. It's hilarious. And not in a good way.
Yeah, that's right. We'd be laughing if it weren't so horrible.
Right.
Yeah.
They are a different type of capitalist.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, and they're, for example, working much harder to emulate the English gentry than their northern mm-hmm. counterparts. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. they're still pretty darn greedy at the end of the day.
Right. Right.
In any case, fourth tenet would be that, and this is important, secessionism, we talked about this in that previous episode, but the secession is about states' rights and preserving the southern way of life. It's not about slavery. This
okay.
is a fundamental pillar of the lost cause, right? In other words, that because you're talking about the cause, but
seceding
the cause
from the Union.
Seceding from the Union is about states' rights. It's about southern independence, right? Or to put it another way, avoiding the growing oppression of the South by the North,
right? Right.
And it's about preserving the quote unquote southern way of life, and it's not about slavery. Fifth tenet would be that, and this is another important pillar. That in the Civil War itself, Confederate armies were never defeated fair and square on the field of battle. They were just overwhelmed by numbers and materiel.
Oh, so if it had been an honorable fight between gentlemen.
Or had it been a fair fight between equal numbers, the South would have won.
Oh, right.
Because okay. Southern generals were better. Southern soldiers were braver.
Mm-hmm.
And only because the Union was in a position to keep throwing materiel and more warm bodies against the Southern Army. That's the only reason. That was a war of attrition. They ground the South down. Because they're soulless capitalists, right. In other words, it was essentially the soulless capitalism applied to military affairs is the way we've
right,
seen
right.
it. And that someone like Ulysses S. Grant, finally they struck upon someone who's just a mindless butcher.
Right.
Who's just willing to put up with enormous casualties, which in some ways he was, but he was a lot more than that. But in other words, so we had this honorable cause and we had an honorable superior army, but only because they had superior numbers did we lose.
Hmm.
And finally, and related to number five is number six, which is that the individual Southern soldier is brave and honorable, and the soldiers' leaders are chivalrous and honorable.
Mm-hmm.
And certain individuals, most of all Robert E. Lee himself, is sort of elevated to, in effect, sainthood.
Yes, absolutely.
Like the better than Napoleon, like the world's most brilliant military commander ever. And mm-hmm. once again, had he had equal numbers, if he had had an industrial economy behind him the way the North did, of course he would have won, because Robert was so just brilliant.
And I fear that a lot of these things have led to a lot of the tensions that exists in the country today. That's
absolutely.
Why it's very, very upsetting that this has gone on for so long.
Most, if not all of these, have ripple effects you can still find today. It's one of the reasons why history is still alive, I would argue, and not just because I'm a historian.
History happens every day, and sometimes it's very upsetting.
Yep, absolutely.
So when was this created? When did the Lost Cause mythology start?
It takes a while, and not coincidentally, it starts after the end of Reconstruction, when former Confederates and white supremacists are now firmly back in charge in the South. And in other words, not just in a position to rule the South and oppress black people, mm-hmm. but they're in a position to help shape the history.
Okay, so we're not talking about the late 1860s, 1870s, even 1880s. We're talking about...
More in the 1890s.
Oh, okay.
A lot of people say the first sort of shot in this war is fired by none other than Jefferson Davis, who I believe publishes his memoirs in 1881, I want to say.
Oh, okay.
He's sort of like the leading edge of the Lost Cause mythology. A lot of other people follow him. Mm-hmm. But certainly when you start to see it really sort of proliferating and sinking roots and people starting to believe it, and it, for example, starting to be taught in Southern schools,
right,
is in the 1890s.
So let me just get check this out. I'm sure I understand this. Make sure the buzzkillers understand. After the Civil War, there's a period of Reconstruction in which a lot of things happen, including African Americans given the vote,
mm-hmm.
And there's an attempt to sort of bring the South into the modern world.
Correct.
But for all sorts of complicated reasons, that fails and ends by 1877,
that's,
1880.
That's right. And basically what happens in 1877 is the last federal troops are withdrawn from the South.
Okay.
And so, in other words, the remaining support that free African Americans had is taken away. And so now former Confederates and white supremacists are free to reestablish their dominance.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay. And so there's a pause in the South, if you will, between the end of the war and the start of this. Okay.
And so what happens, especially after 1890, because it takes a while and it happens at different paces in different states because it's at the state level, obviously.
Yeah.
But basically what happens, especially after 1890, after the federal troops are gone, you have basically the South is Jim Crowed. The Jim Crow South, what's called the Jim Crow South, emerges. And it's basically a comprehensive system of race oppression.
Oh, and just, back to that. Yeah.
Yes. In other words, this is, to put it another way, this is Southerners having lost the Civil War, winning the peace. And mm-hmm. they come up with a substitute for slavery. It's like, yes, mm-hmm. there's a 13th Amendment. They're not allowed to keep African Americans as property, but they can try and come up with the next best thing. And so what you have is a system of race suppression, which is not slavery, but from the standpoint of a former Confederate, it's the next best thing. And it's completely comprehensive. It's social.
Right.
In other words, it's a rigid system of Jim Crow segregation, right? Separate railroad cars and drinking fountains and all that stuff by law, not just by practice.
Oh, wow.
That's part of it. It's economic, where African Americans become substitute slaves in the form of things like tenant farming, sharecropping, debt peonage. In other words, you're basically a you're not a real slave, but you're a debt slave
mm-hmm.
as an individual farmer. Mm-hmm. You don't own any land. You spend the rest of your life in debt, and you hand your debt off to your kids, and they have no choice but to work that land, and you'll always be in debt. And if it sounds a little like slavery, it's because it is kind of.
Oh, especially the generational thing. If your children inherit it by law, then.
Exactly. And then you have things which are getting more attention now, but things like convict leasing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the original mass incarceration, by the way. You imprison, sometimes on bogus charges, large numbers of African-American men, and then the prisons lease them out as farm workers for virtually no money.
Wow.
And it's essentially slavery.
And so all these things comprehensively come under the phrase Jim Crow.
Jim Crow, right. This is a system of this is a replacement for slavery. This is the way the white South dominates and basically brutalizes African Americans in the decades after 1890.
Do we know why it's called Jim Crow?
It's a reference to, in the mid-19th century, one of the most popular forms of popular entertainment were minstrel shows.
Mm-hmm.
And so, remember, there's no movies, there's no radio. People go, even relatively poor people go for live entertainment. And especially across the North, you had this one fellow in particular named T.D. Rice, who was a white person who got blacked up, as they said. He'd put on burnt cork.
Oh, blackface.
Blackface, yeah. And put on rags and dance in this very odd way on stage, which he claimed to be mimicking the way slaves dance. And so this is actually one of the ways that racism against blacks spreads in the white North is these minstrel shows, because he has lots of imitators. In any case, so he would, it was called Jim Crow. He would dance Jim Crow. And that's where the term comes from to basically describe segregation. But I'm using the term even more broadly to talk about this entire system of race oppression.
Because it is comprehensive and it encompasses the entire former Confederacy.
Yeah. And this is why, I'm going to keep in mind, throughout this period, well into the early 20th century, certainly, and well into the so-called Great Migration, where during and after World War I, African Americans start to leave for the North in large numbers, 80 to 90% of the black population lives in the former Confederacy. And so their lives obviously are better than they were under slavery, but they're a living nightmare. And this entire system of race oppression, let's remember, is backed up by terror and violence in the form of lynching.
Wow.
In the 1890s, little factoid, in the 1890s, on average for that decade, you essentially have a lynching somewhere in the United States basically every other day.
Every other day?
Every other day. You have, yeah, typically 180 lynchings a year. By the way, not all lynchings were of black people or even of males, but in other words, basically, we were setting up this system of race oppression. If you step out of line, if you like even make eye contact with a white person or fail to yield on the sidewalk, or if you talk back.
Or if do you those things in the wrong way.
Yeah. Or don't begin a sentence with yes, sir, and or no, sir, you might end up hanged.
Right.
Or tortured to death, as happens in some cases.
Anyways, we talked in the previous show, about the KKK, how at least almost every month in a certain period there was a KKK outrage. But now in this case, we're talking about almost every day there's a lynching.
And this is shocking. And this is no KKK involved.
That's
KKK
right,
doesn't exist in this period. Between the early 1870s, as you pointed out, until 1915, you don't have a Klan.
Yeah.
And you don't need one. You really don't. The race terrorism, and that's what it is. It's violence with a political goal. The terrorism and violence is done by mobs and sometimes by law enforcement. You don't need the Klan.
So in essence, the ebb and flow of the Klan or the establishment and then reestablishment of the Klan doesn't stop this entire period until the mid 1960s is official.
Right. Right.
Government oppression.
Actually, if you look at something like lynching, well, not official government oppression.
Okay,
we'll put it that way. It's usually, you should not think of it as rough justice either. This is about terror. This is about keeping African Americans, especially African American males, quote unquote, in line.
Right.
But lynching itself, it's interesting. Lynching fades as a practice starting in the 1920s. By the time you get to the 30s and 40s, it's increasingly rare, just as a practice. You still have Jim Crow. You still have segregation, right?
Okay.
Until the civil rights movement, all that stuff's in place. But lynching actually starts to fade out. And things like the murder of Emmett Till in 1955, that becomes an extraordinary event. Whereas 40 years earlier, it would have been routine.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah. When I have these coming to the realization sounds I'm making, the tragedy of all this and the sadness of all this is only doubled by the fact that, we have to be told that all these things are happening all the time.
Yeah. No. So the Lost Cause says that antebellum life is worth reinstating as far as possible. In other words, if you look at those things, that the Jim Crow system, it's all backed up by the Lost Cause myth. For example, during this period of race oppression, you are systematically taking away the right of African Americans to vote, which had been granted during Reconstruction. The Lost Cause helps justify that. The Lost Cause says, look at the Lost Cause. Slaves were happy. And the system worked because slaves were in their proper place. Reconstruction freed African Americans and gave them the right to vote. That was an abomination. It ruined the South. And what we're doing is we are reestablishing the way things used to be in effect. Not slavery, but the next best thing. African Americans are kept under heel. They're systematically oppressed. And that's necessary because of what this Lost Cause myth says.
Okay.
So this is not just a myth. This is not just sort of out there and this sort of belief system that is sort of romantic and you like reading about it. It has everyday consequences. It helps. It's a rationalization.
Wow.
In case anyone wonders, why are we treating black people this way? Well, it's because evil Yankees did away with slavery.
Right.
And African Americans are not equal to us and they're not suited for freedom. They're not suited for independence or the right to vote. And so, unfortunately, we have to establish this system of Jim Crow segregation as the next best thing.
We're reestablishing the way things should be, but we're disrupted by the
Civil War.
Okay.
Right. So the whole Lost Cause myth is not just an academic exercise. It's really, really important in justifying the nightmare that is black life in the South between 1890 and, 1965, more or less. There are other purposes for the Lost Cause, however, for the sort of basic primal level, it takes the sting out of defeat for white Southerners.
Yeah, yeah.
And let's remember that No one likes to lose. No one likes to lose a war. No one likes to make massive sacrifices in a war and then lose. Lots of countries in history have reacted, shall we say, poorly to defeat. Mm-hmm. Look at Germany after World War One, for example.
After World War One, yeah.
After World War One, the sting of that defeat helps lead to the rise of Adolf Hitler. We've sort of talked about that in a previous episode.
Yeah.
Look at how long it takes the United States to get over its loss in Vietnam. And by that, I mean sort of the recriminations, the finger pointing, the bitterness, the division.
Yeah.
You still see that today.
Right.
Even among historians, by the way, you still see these divisions and this sort of gut level emotional response to having been defeated and having sacrificed a lot and had lost and having had lost. That's very, very painful. The lost cause myth acts as sort of a salve, sort of an ointment for this sort of wounded pride. And largely what the Southerners are doing after the end of Reconstruction is they're trying to rebuild their pride and their self-esteem, having lost. And so lost cause myth helps you do that. And yeah, I would say in some ways even more important than that, it's also the lost cause myth is a crucial part of the reconciliation process between North and South.
Oh, okay.
And some historians like David Blight have written a lot about this.
Yeah.
It's been covered quite a bit by some excellent history writing. But keep in mind that just like there's no guidebook that shows you how to or whether to secede, there's no guidebook on how to fight a civil war, there's certainly no guidebook on how do you reunify after the Civil War.
Yeah, because it's not only reunifying winners and losers, but it's reunifying after slavery has been abolished.
You've crushed the Confederate armies.
Mm-hmm.
Now what?
Yeah.
How do you let these states back in? And already during the Civil War, you had debates among Republicans in the North. How do you treat the conquered South? Lincoln, but one of the fascinating what ifs, what if Lincoln lives? Because all the signs he gave was that he was going to be rather lenient.
Yes.
Yeah. He might have changed.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm trying to think through these scenarios. I can't imagine a scenario that would have worked out really well one way or another. Keep in mind that the Southerners always had the option of resorting to guerrilla warfare after 1865.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a fear at the time. In fact, one of the reasons why people have a kind disposition toward Robert E. Lee is that he basically surrendered and told all his troops just go home.
Yes, don't put that flag away or something. Yeah. He didn't mean to say that, but it's the sentiment expressed.
And
yeah.
Shared by others. Now, by the way, as you pointed out, you did have former Confederates who put on white robes and do fight and engage in acts of terror. But still, you could have had – the South is a big area with some very rugged terrain here and there. You could have had a very successful – it could have been the Boer War all over again. You could have had unending conflict. It's conceivable.
Yeah.
So the question is how do you reconcile these – two countries, and you had all these debates, and Reconstruction era was a very complicated mess, partly because you had no clear way to bring these states back into the Union.
Right.
After Reconstruction, Southerners are all back in the political system. You have Southerners represented in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Right there, right? They get to vote again. The states are part of the Union, but how do you reconcile as peoples? How do white Northerners and white Southerners bury the hatchet? How do they get along again? Turns out one of the ways you do this is with the lost cause myth. And that Northerners come to agree, not all of them, and certainly not at first, but a lot of Northerners come to share the Southern view of what the Civil War was all about.
That's one of the most amazing developments in U.S. history.
Pretty amazing. And like I said, there were some Northerners who resisted.
But when put in this context, it's sort of more understandable, because if they're trying to make the 1880s, 1890s, and so on more livable, then, well, maybe giving into this is an immediate fix.
Right, and on the one hand, if you're trying to reconcile and you see the other side, i.e. the South, if you see they're sort of intransigent and they're starting to construct their own version of history, you could make a good case that you should be magnanimous and you should bend a little bit.
Wow.
But basically, let's put it this way, the Southerners who are trying to write history are much more devoted and much more committed, much more dogged in their efforts than their Northern counterparts are. In some ways, Northerners have just sort of moved on. This is one of the reasons why African Americans are abandoned in 1877. It's because Northerners, a lot of Northerners, including Northerners who had been abolitionists, sort of move on.
Reconstruction stops in 1877.
Right. Well, and also chicken and egg. I mean, it stops because they've abandoned them.
Okay, right.
They're no longer sort of engaging in politics to protect African Americans. Eric Foner, I think, put it very, very well. He basically says that after the Civil War, there are two ways to remember the Civil War. One type of memory, he says, is emancipationist.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, like, for example, look at Lincoln's famous Gettysburg Address, which, by the way, is super short. And if people haven't read it, they should read it. It's an amazing document, and it's an important document. Because this, we talked in the earlier episode about war aims. This is where he basically lays it out. It's like this is not just a war for reunion. This is a war to, what he says, bring about a new birth of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we're going to finally uphold that part of the Constitution that talks about all men being created equal, which is up until this point has been a lie. He doesn't say that in effect, but that's in effect, but that's what he means. So there's this emancipationist. In other words, the war is about a rebirth of freedom and equality. It's about bringing freedom and ultimately citizenship to all people, including black people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the emancipationist type of memory. The conflicting one is what he calls reconciliationist. And this is pushed most strongly by former Confederates. And as I'm saying here, Northerners increasingly go along with it. It emphasizes what the two sides had in common. For example, the valor of individual soldiers. And long after the Civil War, you're going to have all these events, like on the 50th and even 75th anniversary of Gettysburg, where you have Union and Confederate veterans get together, maybe in the presence of the President of the United States.
They shake hands.
They shake hands, and they sort of swap stories. And
I remember when you shot at me.
Right, exactly. And it becomes an important symbolic piece of this reconciliationist puzzle. But basically what happens is the lost cause, i.e. the reconciliationist version, wins out, and the emancipationist one goes by the boards.
Wow. And as you say, the Northerners acquiesce.
Yes. And so that's part of my message here, is that Northerners are part of the problem. The Northerners, I would argue, looking back, are much too quick to sort of forget what they were fighting about.
Yeah.
And so how does this manifest itself? For example, and you still see this today, you still see this in history books, where 1861 becomes this generic tragedy.
1861 being the start of the war.
Being the start of the Civil War. It becomes a tragedy. Now, think about that for a minute. I mean, to the extent that 1861 leads to 1865, i.e. a Northern victory that not only keeps the country together, but crushes slavery for once and for all, 1861 is not a tragedy. It's painful. The cost is extremely high. But you can argue that by 1860, the country was going to, one way or another, pay an extremely high cost to get rid of its original sin, which is slavery, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the central contradiction of American history, slavery in the land of liberty.
Right.
That's not going to be solved easily.
No.
But when it's solved, that's something you celebrate. It's not something you forget.
Right.
Once again, it's like, oh, yeah, it was so great that was a war for a union. I didn't say it in the other episode, but I put it this way. A country that preserves slavery is not worth reunifying.
Right, yeah.
What is the purpose of reunifying a country that enslaves 4 million people? What's the purpose?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, you're still preserving this land of liberty for white people. But
yeah.
There's that elephant in the middle of the room.
And
right?
it's going to get even worse because it's going to be in the middle of the room longer.
Exactly. So then you'll have Northern and Southerners basically shaking their heads saying, wow, what a tragedy. What were we fighting for anyway?
Brother against brother.
Right. It becomes a sort of family squabble without any content. As David Blight put it, and I'm quoting, passion and heroism immunized from motive.
Yes.
Which I think is a great quote, right? Becomes, you say, wow, what great soldiers they were. Why were they fighting? Forget about that. But look what great soldiers they were.
Yeah.
And how sad it was that so many of them had to die.
And so many of the stories are dramatic. There are these pickets charge and these sorts of things that seem like the heroic.
Right. And so you play up and, you know, you'll still see it. Even look at something like, it's an excellent series, but Ken Burns' Civil War series on PBS.
Right.
It's overwhelmingly a military history.
Right?
I mean, you become almost bogged down. I mean, it's very, very well done. Don't get me wrong. And I enjoy watching it like anybody else. But there are long stretches of that where it just becomes sort of immersed in these military details. And obviously, every 5 minutes, you don't put the sort of, trailer down at the bottom. By the way, this is all about slavery.
there should have been more about that. They used the term states' rights far too often.
And they were and they rely yeah. way too heavily on Shelby Foote.
Way too often, who's a great
historian, but also very sort of pro-Confederate in some ways.
Yeah.
In any case, we won't get into that. But
no, there's before a whole show
long,
on that.
But before too long, you have prominent Union veterans like Oliver Wendell Holmes, future Supreme Court Justice.
Yeah.
Who, and by the way, this is great because he's quoted, I think at the very beginning of the Civil War series, he said, "In our youths, our hearts were touched with fire," which is a great quote, but it's also devoid of content.
Yeah, they could have been touched with fire about all kinds
exactly.
of things. Exactly, foreign
and,
war.
And he is the one who this is a virtual quotation. He says that Union and Confederate veterans were one in feeling and experience.
Well, they certainly weren't one in feeling.
No, and by the way, and that's something you could say about all soldiers in all wars. It's like, yeah, if you boil it down to the experience of a soldier, yes, they all have something in common. Combat is horrible. It's traumatic.
Yeah,
you can suffer death or horrible wounds. You're sacrificed, right? You might be traumatized for the rest of your life. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Okay, now what? Right? Why should that commonality be used to eclipse the reason you're fighting in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that's sort of I hesitate to use this phrase, but a crime against history.
Yeah, and crime against history is a phrase we should keep thinking about when we talk about the lost cause, because that's what it is.
Right. But then, so this basically becomes, in a way, to the extent that Union soldiers embraced emancipation, and not all of them did. But by the way, a lot of Union veterans were African Americans and former slaves themselves, by the way. About a fifth of the Union Army were African American. Let's not forget.
Yeah.
But it's an insult to Union veterans who embraced emancipation. It's certainly an insult to Lincoln.
Right.
Right. If you erase the extent of this is the extent to which this is about slavery, you're basically saying, we'll give Lincoln half credit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He deserves to be revered. Well, like in the Lincoln Memorial, let's revere him for unifying the country. But let's not talk anything about the content of the country or what happens to slaves. If Lincoln's ghost were to return and he would see all this lost cause reconciliationism sweeping the land, I'm sure he would say, okay, yeah, I reunified the country. But what about this other part?
Yeah, right.
Don't I get some credit for that? In some ways, the sort of the harder pull.
Yeah. Right?
So it's a degradation of the Union cause, and it's a betrayal of Northerners by Northerners, including some of the same people, right?
Oh, that's very interesting.
If you're a reconciliationist in 1900, in 1865, you would have had no doubt about what the stakes were.
That's
fascinating. But by 1900, you have convinced yourself, yeah, what a shame. Couldn't we have all gotten along? Couldn't we have worked it out? Right? It's almost like it was an accident. It's like we tripped and ended up in the Civil War. It's like, no, this didn't just happen.
It took more than a decade. The 1850s were, and it could go all the way back to 1848, as you said.
And it was the issue on the national docket for, like I said, or like you said, like a decade or more. And all of a sudden, it gets written out of history.
It just gets worse. This whole thing about the lost cause gets worse and worse and worse the further you dig into it.
Yep. And so basically what happens here is reconciliation is not just reconciliation. It's reconciliation on Southern terms. Mm. Southerners are basically the terrain of history is yielded to Southerners, either actively or passively. Some Northerners just can't be bothered to wage that fight, to write the books, right?
Yeah.
To go out there into the public realm and fight the battle. And others say, yeah, you know what? It really wasn't about slavery. It was a war between the states.
Oh, that's the worst one.
The preferred Southern term, or if you're, I'm sorry, not all Southerners, obviously, but if you're neo-Confederate or pro-Confederate, you call it the war between the states, you don't call it a civil war. Or if you're really extreme, you call it the war of Northern aggression, which I think is hilarious also.
Yeah, I like when someone starts calling it the war of states' rights and tariffs, then I really get it.
Exactly, that's just around the corner.
Yeah.
This is also partly about party politics, and the timing, once again, is interesting. It's in 1896 that the official Republican strategy, remember this is coming right after a Democratic administration of Grover Cleveland, his second administration.
Right.
So the crucial, in many ways, election of 1896.
Well, I don't know anyone except you and a few other people that would remember that. But yeah.
Who's the one president who served two non-consecutive terms? That would be Grover Cleveland.
Yeah.
And by the way, Wilson is the only Democrat between Grover Cleveland and FDR.
Republican
dominance, which is launched in 1896. But in that election year, official Republican Party strategy was basically renewed nationalism.
Yeah.
I.e. get Americans to be thinking of themselves as proud Americans, proud unified Americans. Renewed nationalism based on reconciliation. And I was thinking about this. You might even call this the original Southern strategy.
Yeah, because they're not basing it on the Northern feeling of the war. They're basing it on the Southern feeling of the war.
Exactly. They're trying to peel off votes. They're not just successful, by the way, in terms of winning Southern votes. They're going to win the election overwhelmingly.
All right.
But basically, remember, the South is the quote unquote solid South. It is dominated by the Democrats going back well before the Civil War. Let's remember, in 1860, Abraham Lincoln wasn't even on the ballot in Southern states. You couldn't vote for him.
Right.
You couldn't vote for him. Well, you could vote for him as a write-in, I suppose. But he's not even on the ballot. That shows you how far things had gone.
And it would have been a waste of time if he had been. Yeah.
Correct. Exactly. He wouldn't have gotten any votes. No self-respecting white Southerner would have voted for Lincoln in 1860. Maybe a few. In any case, in 1896, the Republican Party officially, for the first time since 1865, drops the demand that the U.S. government enforce black suffrage. So at least, and I remember, and of course, context and sort of, let's be realistic, even to, certainly today, but even to some extent back then, just because you put in your party platform doesn't mean you're actually going to act on it.
Right. Okay. I see. Yeah.
But it is a statement of what your party stands for, much more important then than today, what we stand for, what our issues are. In every GOP platform after 1865, there was an official statement embracing black suffrage. Black people deserve the right to vote, and we should go to the mat for it. In 1896, it's dropped.
Wow.
That is what we call Southern outreach. They are trying to be less sort of sectional, less sort of partisan in a sort of sectional way.
Right.
They're trying to reach out to white Southerners, and the way you do that, it's emblematic. It's part of this larger reconciliation project, which is done on the backs of African Americans at their expense. They are the losers in this.
And that's 1896.
That's 1896.
I wonder if that's the time when the Republican Party starts to become a more national.
Starts to try. Yeah, it doesn't really succeed, but it's part of this larger reconciliation project.
Let's go for a sponsorship break, and when we get back, we'll talk about the real turning point in this reconciliation that Professor Nash is talking about. Back in a minute. All right, we're back. Professor, I'm still astonished with this lost cause myth that it's still going on in the 1890s. In fact, it's still going on now, but it really starts to take off in the 1890s.
That's right.
Why is that?
For lots of reasons. One of them, as we mentioned before the break, is about sort of partisan politics.
Yeah.
The Republican Party trying to reach out. 1890s is also, of course, when Jim Crow segregation is largely being established, blacks are being denied the vote, et cetera. 1898, by the way, is the year when the city of Wilmington, North Carolina, becomes the site of, as far as I know, the only successful military coup d'etat in American history.
What?
Where white supremacists used armed force to unseat the duly elected government of the town.
Wilmington, North Carolina had its own Fort Sumter moment?
Yeah. Buzzkiller should Google Wilmington, NC, 1898. He'll find out all about it. It's pretty appalling, actually. There were other attempted coup d'etats, like Liberty Place, 1874 in New Orleans, which we'll mention later.
Okay.
But that was, as far as I know, the only successful military coup d'etat paramilitary coup d'etat, in American history.
So the Appomattox, is 1865, but this is still happening, cropping up every now and then.
In some ways, the Civil War is still going on. In any case, 1898 turns out is also a key year in the history of reconciliation because of the Spanish-American War. And in retrospect, it's not surprising. In all countries, certainly in ours, you rally around the flag when you have a foreign threat.
When you have a foreign threat, right?
Yeah. That's one thing that's going to bring everyone together. Keep in mind, it's also been now, at least a generation since the Civil War.
You have a
generation of young people, most infamously like Teddy Roosevelt, who are literally itching to fight somebody in a war. It's hard to exaggerate in his case.
Because all their heroes would have fought in the Civil War.
Right. I remember also in his case, his dad was someone who avoided military service during the Civil War.
Okay.
And he's trying, it's partly this sort of father-son thing, where he's trying to show up dad. In any case, he's sort of a psycho in some ways.
I should remind the Duke of Buzzkill that I'm not worried about his avoiding service in the Korean Vietnam Wars.
Just so we're clear.
I'm past it.
Classic. But here's an opportunity for reunification, and it happens literally on the battlefield because you have a lot of former Confederates who basically join the United States Army, because the United States Army expands very, very quickly in 1898 to fight the Spanish.
Wait, they're the Confederate veterans joining the army in 1898?
Yes.
They must be 80 years
old. Some of them are old. Yeah, they're basically generals. They're not being sent into combat as privates. Yeah. Yeah. We weren't that hard up for young men. In fact, quite the contrary. Right? Remember, this is a weird war. This is where someone like, yeah. once again, Teddy Roosevelt is allowed to form his own volunteer cavalry regiment just sort of on the side, which is just so hilarious when you think about it. Oversubscribed, by the way. He had to turn away a large number of volunteers. In any case, some of the volunteers were people like former Confederate cavalry general Joe Wheeler, who was a big deal during the Civil War. He was a very successful Confederate cavalry commander. He is sent into combat in Cuba, not literally in combat, but in command. Yeah. And apparently there is one battle where the Americans are sort of getting the upper hand against their Spanish opponents. And he says, it's not a direct quote, but in effect, come on, boys, we've got the Yankees on the run.
The Yankees? Wait, you mean the Spanish who are fleeing, he's saying
to
his soldiers, so we've got the Yankees on the run.
He has sort of a flashback moment is what I'm thinking, right? It's like old habits die hard, and once the juices get going and you're in combat again for the first time in 33 years, it's easy to forget where you are and what you're doing.
Or maybe he did it on purpose. Maybe he thought he'd rile up the Southerners in his command.
And also possible. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, in any case, I think it's a great little vignette. It's like you can take the soldier out of the Confederacy, but you can't take the Confederacy out of the soldier. That's how I would interpret
it. So again, it just keeps rolling on.
Right. But this is really important for reconciliation because basically, I'll put it this way. With 1898, it becomes okay for a Southerner to fly a U.S. flag again.
Oh, all right. Oh, because of the Spanish-American
War.
Right. Gotcha.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Because now it's like, here's where we bury the hatchet. We join each other on the same side in combat against a foreign enemy.
Oh, okay.
And that, in long term, and historians have looked at this, the long term, this seems to be a really, maybe not a turning point, but a really important point in the development of reconciliation.
Yeah.
Right? Where you can put on the same uniform, sort of salute the same flag, fight side by side against the same enemy, symbolically at least. Obviously, not every Southerner takes part in the military, just like every Northerner doesn't. But it becomes a really important symbolic moment where the two sides can fight together. Now, it doesn't, obviously, there's still huge regional differences after this, but it's an important step toward reconciliation.
Gotcha.
Thereafter, you see this over and over again in popular culture. You talked a lot about Birth of a Nation.
On the KKK episode.
It's really hard to exaggerate the importance of that movie in this sense, right?
Yeah,
because remember, many more people watch even the early silent films than read books.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
More people saw that movie than read The Klansman by Thomas Dixon.
Yeah, yeah.
So where those ideas are also spread. But
it's also a very long movie, and people go to see it, and it's a huge hit. So it's not as
if
it's just some little 30-minute splash and run documentary.
People, if they can sit through even part of it, they should, because it's hard to watch. But you see all these white actors in blackface.
Yeah.
And there's one scene, for example, that I've seen where a black villain chases this young white virgin, and she commits suicide rather than falling into his clutches, which is really powerful trope of the Jim Crow period, right?
Exactly.
In other words, we have to brutalize black males to protect white womanhood, right? Mm-hmm. That's a huge justification for lynching, among other things, even though it's a complete myth.
Right.
So you also see it in things like Gone with the Wind, which...
20 years later, but
20
still
years
the same
later,
story.
When you have the book and the movie, which are both huge, by the way, parenthetically, Adolf Hitler, huge fan of the movie Gone with the Wind.
You're kidding.
It was actually banned in the Third Reich, as I think most American movies were in 1941 when the two countries went to war.
Yeah.
But remember, Hitler, a big movie fan and a huge fan of The Gone with the Wind.
No kidding.
And there have been articles written recently in New York Times or Washington Post, where it talks about how Hitler lamented the demise of the Confederacy. And he had no regard for Americans, by the way, but he thought to the extent that Americans were worth anything, it was the Confederate attempt to establish a racial state.
Hitler bought into the lost cause myth.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, I guess it makes perfect sense.
It's him being remarkably consistent, actually, sort of recognized white supremacy when he saw it. In any case, there are other aspects to the lost cause myth. One, generally, it's about conservative traditions serving as a bulwark in a period where you've got radical change.
Southern conservatism.
Southern conservatism and these traditions. Remember, the 1890s, early 1900s, real tumultuous period in this country. Rapid industrialization. You've got anarchism. You've got the growth of unions.
Immigration.
You've got mass immigration, and by the way, of not the quote-unquote right sort of people. These are not Scots-Irish. Right. These are not Scots-Irish coming in. These are Italians and Poles and Russians and Greeks and, of course, the quote-unquote wrong sort of person. It's a period of rapid, of frightening change to a lot of people. So Southern traditions seem all the more worthy of emulation.
All right.
And it's also a way of airbrushing out differences among whites. A subtext in The Lost Cause is that white Southerners before the Civil War were basically all one big happy family.
Right. Okay.
And that you didn't have like class tensions, for example.
Yeah.
That even if you weren't a plantation owner, you still revered the plantation and the sort of quote unquote Southern way of life.
And that has to be untrue.
Of course that's untrue.
We know it's untrue from evidence, but it's
also
common
sense. And I alluded to it earlier. Lee is right in not the sense he meant, but I would argue that slavery is in part bad for white people in that it freezes this gross inequality among whites in place.
Right. Robert E. Lee.
The North in 1860, for all of its faults, had more economic mobility than the South did. In the South, as a white person, by the way, you have lots of reasons to support slavery and not only your racism. You might, for example, make money off of the plantation system, even if you're not a plantation owner.
Sure.
Because nevertheless, in the South does not invest a dime in public education of white people
because
of slavery.
Yeah. Okay.
So.
Oh, I see. Right.
Right. So in other words, these are the sort of classes, and you had a lot of class divisions, even during the Civil War. You had enormous class divisions in North and South, but including in the South, where, for example, if you were a plantation owner, you had one white exemption from the draft for every 20 slaves you owned.
Oh, really?
Yes. It was called the, well, I'll clean it up. It was called the 20 Negro Rule.
Wow.
For every 20 slaves you owned, you got one white male exempted from military service. Think about that for just a minute.
All your male children could be.
Can you imagine anything that is a more open declaration of class warfare from above than that? Right?
Oh, my goodness.
If you're part of the 3/4 of the population that owns no slaves, sorry, you have to go serve.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, the North had its own version. Someone like Teddy Roosevelt's dad could buy his way out of combat. You could pay a fee. Or you could hire a replacement. So there was class warfare in the North, too. But, boy, there was plenty of it in the South. And that sort of thing all gets elided, gets sort of airbrushed out by the Lost Cause myth. A couple other things. There is a big, and I'm just going to mention them, there's a big religious dimension to the Lost Cause.
Yes, we see this again and again and again.
The implication, if not the outright claim, is that Southerners in the antebellum period were superior Christians.
Right. There were no Catholics, is one of the arguments made.
Right. Catholic was, that was a Northern thing because of immigration, right?
Yeah.
White immigration is not really happening in the South, partly because of slavery, by the way. But the idea that the South is more Christian, that that Southern Confederate leaders, Confederate soldiers were basically, they knew their Bible better. They were more faithful to God. And so the South was not just a nation, but a Christian nation. One last aspect is that women played an enormous role in the propagation and sustaining of the Lost Cause myth.
So did they all want to be Scarlett O'Hara's?
In a way, yeah. You had a lot of women, obviously, particularly those in the middle and upper class who had the time and the resources to devote to this, but who not only sort of play up the role, which didn't need any playing up, it was important, but play up the role of women during the Civil War.
Yes.
And then after the Civil War, see it as their sort of contribution to preserving Southern culture and Southern civilization to memorialize.
Oh, right.
The
okay.
United Daughters of the Confederacy, the UDC.
Right, right.
Really tough to exaggerate their importance. They lead the charge, for example, in building, raising money and building a lot of these Confederate monuments.
Monuments, yeah.
And in also spreading the Lost Cause myth. So this is not, we're not just talking about men here by any stretch. A lot of quote-unquote Southern belles or other white Southern women are playing a big role in this.
And in radical, violent versions of the Lost Cause myth, there is a lot of rhetoric about protecting white womanhood in the South.
Right. And then it becomes fascinating because, not to get too deeply into it, but basically race and gender intersect.
Yeah.
And so the... lynching is justified by the alleged need to protect your quote-unquote your Southern white women from lascivious black males, but that also justifies patriarchy. That justifies the oppression of white women in the name of their own protection. So if you are
protect their purity.
So if you are it's a seamless system. If you're a white Southern male, it's great for you. Because your gender and race dominance are both assured because they're both connected to each other.
So again, we're going back to this idea that it becomes comprehensive.
Yep, absolutely. And because it's comprehensive and becomes entrenched, very hard to root out.
Yeah, it is the Lost Cause myth.
And it dies really, really hard. But while we're on that subject, let's just, for record-keeping sake, let's go through the Lost Cause myth, because I've sort of asserted that it's a myth, and I haven't actually talked about its tenets as mythological.
Well, in the beginning, you do. Yeah, but yeah, I see what you mean. I see what
right,
you
no,
mean.
Right, sort of, to sort of break it down briefly, for example, the antebellum South was glorified as this sort of idyllic place. I've already implied it. Let me say
South before the war.
Yeah. South before the Civil War was not idyllic. You can't look at these bucolic, allegedly bucolic plantations and say, wow, how nice. By the way, I have to tell you this. I heard once about some folks who visited one of these plantations, which are now open for tours in the South. I was not actually there. And in fairness, apparently some of them do a much better job of contextualizing themselves and talking about slavery than they used to.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one particular tour, the docents are volunteers and some older white Southern women. We might even call them Southern Belles, right? Very genteel.
Yeah.
And volunteer their time to lead people around these plantations. And someone asked very naively, marveling at the condition and the beauty of the grounds, saying, wow, how did they keep these places so nice? And the response from the docent was, and I'm quoting, they had help.
And that was it.
They
had help. The help. Yeah.
So ignorance meets obfuscation.
Oh, right.
End of story. Yeah. In any case.
Well, I hope that those places are doing, some of them are doing a very good job. I hope they're doing a lot better than
they are. Although, in fairness, let's keep in mind, when tourists go to a big plantation, they're not looking to learn about the slave quarters.
No.
And about what went on. They want to see what a fabulous house it is, and look at how beautiful this is. And in other words, they want to do their part to preserve the Lost Cause myth.
Yeah, and I've read articles about the gentrification of slave quarters, where they spruce them up and make them look a lot better than they
always
were.
Always a danger. And keep in mind that, like with sort of the Holocaust, you could never, ever faithfully recreate it. And conveying its true nature is virtually impossible.
Yeah.
Right, movies, for example, about the Holocaust and slavery are never, ever going to be accurate because you couldn't show them.
No.
You couldn't. In any case.
You literally couldn't film them.
So as I've already sort of talked about this, but the South before 1860 is a place of gross inequality even among whites. Slavery means you have no social mobility, no investment in education. There's a reason why, in some ways even today, but certainly well into the 20th century, the South economically is sort of a third world country for the North.
Right, right.
Where, for example, it's all about extractive industries like tar and timber and raw materials, which are then sent north where the so-called value added is added and the money is made.
And then later cotton.
And later cotton or other things. You know, it's going to be mechanized. But in any case, the planters, as I mentioned, are equally greedy to northern capitalists.
Right.
So the idea that the antebellum South is this idyllic, prosperous, peaceful place is a myth.
I forgot the name of the father, the patriarch in Gone with the Wind, the supposed Irish guy.
Oh, God, yeah.
But the idea that there are these father figures who are the head planter, the head owner of the entire plantation, taking care of everybody.
Right. And that the slaves are, quote unquote, part of the family.
Yeah.
That is a pernicious myth on its own, which, yes, you see in Gone with the Wind and elsewhere. A lot of other movies too, by the way.
Yeah, it's insidious.
It is indeed. Secondly, let's just be clear that chattel slavery is evil.
Right.
I can't do it here. Like I said, you can't do it in a movie. You cannot completely capture the unspeakable brutality of slavery. The closest I've seen to this done in a movie is in 12 Years a Slave.
Yes, I've heard very good things about that. I haven't seen it.
You should see it, and the Buzzkiller should see it too. It's, by the way, not only an outstanding movie, it's also very, very faithful to the book, 12 Years a Slave.
The book is very good.
Solomon Northup's book is amazing. The movie does, I think, about as good a job as you could do, not only to capture the brutality of slavery, but just all of the pain all around, and then how slavery degrades everything it touches and everyone it touches, including the slave owners, which, you're not supposed to feel bad for them, but you're supposed to fully understand just how bad slavery is.
Yeah, it dehumanizes them as well.
It dehumanizes them as well. But for the slave, as was mentioned in that Civil War series, it's all night for the slave, all night forever. Beatings, murder, rape, overwork, separation of families.
Right.
Apart from outright genocide, in part from perhaps treatment of Native Americans, it's certainly the most brutal aspect of American history, without comparison, basically.
And we shouldn't qualify it.
No.
Apart from those things, It is the most brutal aspect.
And the whole idea that anyone for even a second, and even in a mild way, would suggest, slavery wasn't all that bad. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And you can, if you get in your picture of, get in your mind a picture of how bad slavery is, it's even worse than that. It's you can't imagine it. Yeah. I can't imagine it. And so what about the North? The North is a mess in many ways too, right? This is part of the Lost Cause myth, is how bad the North is. Certainly early industrial capitalism is not a pretty picture. I'm not going to make any defense of that. But like I said, there is more social mobility, more education certainly, right? This is a period in the mid-19th century where free mandatory public education starts to take off. We take it for granted. It didn't exist in the early part of American history. It starts to take off, not in the South.
And some people do work themselves up from nothing the North, and that's not possible.
Even
in
the factory system in its early days, pre-unions, there is some, not a lot, but there is some social mobility. And one of the reasons they're educating you is because they want to see which of the workers might become foremen.
Yeah.
So it's all relative, but do that comparison.
Yeah.
In terms of social mobility and education, the North wins, it seems to me, in that picture. Fourth, we talked about this before, the war is almost entirely about slavery. Fifth, it's true this Confederate Army does amazingly well versus long odds. I do not want to diminish the achievement, especially of the Army of Northern Virginia. If you read about a lot of its victorious battles early on, even some of the later ones, it does an amazing job. It is a very tough army. It's very disciplined. Robert E. Lee does a magnificent job leading it. He schools a series of hapless Northern opponents, and it gives Lincoln fits trying to find the right guy. But this war is not just about numbers. The United States Army does a great job early on in the West. I would argue that the overfocus
about the West
over
the
overfocus on the Eastern theater, I would argue, is an ancillary part of the Lost Cause, because you focus all about, it's all about Chancellorsville, it's all about Bull Run and Second Bull Run, it's all about the 7 Days Battle, Antietam, Gettysburg. Things in the West are generally ignored, and that's where the war goes fantastically well for the Union. Early on.
Yeah.
And this is where Grant, by the way, is part of it, and Grant works his way up in the West. But the war goes very well for the U.S. in the West early on. The North has some great generals, true, and not just Grant, who's not just a butcher. He's actually, you can argue, he's one of the greatest military commanders in all of American history if you look at his battlefield performance. Other people around him who he, by the way, notices and helps promote, people like Sherman and Sheridan.
Mm-hmm.
People should go look, for example, just one example, look at Sherman's Atlanta campaign.
Right.
Where he fights from the Chattanooga area of southeast Tennessee down to Atlanta in the summer of 1864.
Yeah.
That campaign is a masterpiece. With one exception, he, with very few casualties, outmaneuvers his opponent and forces him back into the defenses of Atlanta.
Wow.
Or look at Grant's campaign around Vicksburg,
mm-hmm.
where he isolates and puts under siege the city of Vicksburg, which is ultimately going to open up all the Mississippi Valley to Union control. That is still taught in the military academies. It is a masterpiece. The kind of thing you would normally associate with Robert E. Lee. Mm-hmm, I'm associating with Ulysses Grant.
Because you think of Lee, or people, especially Lost Causers, think of Lee as the great, not only gentleman general, but the brilliant general. And where Sherman may seem like a brutal northerner, he is the genius general.
And the untrue stereotypes of Grant, not only that he's a butcher, but also that he's a drunk, those are myths.
Right. Yeah.
Those are myths. Those are ancillary to the Lost Cause. It's like, look at this guy, Grant. Shows up in his muddy private's uniform. Like, what a cad. Look at the elegant cavalier Robert E. Lee.
Slave owning.
Yeah, exactly. And that juxtaposition of Appomattox, and you see it in the paintings as well. That's part of the Lost Cause.
Can I ask one question, Neil? Because one myth, one of our shows with you on it that's done such a great job was the clean Wehrmacht myth, where we talked about the average German soldier's responsibility for the Nazi government, and that the clean soldier, clean German soldier, is also part of myth. Do we know anything about what the average run-of-the-mill Confederate soldier thought about the causes of the Civil War and slavery? In other words, is there a clean Confederate army myth?
Yes, to some extent. By the way, we know something about what soldiers thought through their letters. Some of their letters have survived.
Okay. All right.
We know something about this. And a lot of it is about patriotism, in the case of the South, patriotism to the Southern cause.
To the Southern cause, okay.
Right?
Remembering, of course, the Southern cause is overwhelmingly slavery.
That's right. You would certainly have some Southern soldiers who wouldn't talk about slavery in their letters. Certainly they would talk about defending their home or fighting for their comrades, the sort of thing the soldiers always talk about. There is certainly a myth in the broader sense that the South fought honorably and the North didn't.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
There is a lot to that. Let me get to that in a minute, because I wanted to mention a couple more things about the whole leadership thing, because we focus on Lee. He's great. We focus on his opponents, who were losers. And so then that shapes the entire picture. There are not only brilliant Northern generals, there are not so good Confederate generals. People like Braxton Bragg and John Pemberton and John Bell Hood and Richard Ewell. These are not household names, but they're really important Confederates who helped them lose battles.
Oh. Never think about that.
Leaving aside men and material, et cetera, if you look at battles, these are people who just don't do right. Hood, for example, he's responsible for the one case in a Civil War battle, which was not just a defeat, but an annihilation, and where your army basically disappears. That's the Battle of Nashville and the Battle of Franklin in 1864.
He's responsible.
Responsible. He basically commits suicide. He commits his army's suicide by Union Army, in effect. Go read about Franklin and Nashville in 1864. It's not the best Confederate generalship, not even close. And I would also argue down to the bottom that Union soldiers are equally brave and gallant and human. And this gets into your question a second ago, which is how the two armies behave. I believe there are some people who think that if you look at Sherman's March to the Sea, that's the sort of gritty, nasty, modern in a bad way warfare,
right,
that dragged the nature of Civil War combat down into the gutter.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically it's no holds barred, it's brutal, it's brute force, it's war against civilians, et cetera. You know, the whole marching through Georgia, et cetera, that is a trope. That is a big part of the lost cause. If you look at behavior on both sides in the Civil War, let's just say there is plenty of blame to go around on both sides.
Yes.
Yeah. Right? Let's look at prisons, for example. Mm-hmm. Prisons, none of them were good. All of them had significant death rates due to disease and exposure. In its own category is Andersonville Prison in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Andersonville Prison is a place where 13,000 Union soldiers died, largely because of neglect and disease and sort of lack of provision, but also from some murders. It was a uniquely brutal place. And by the way, one of the reasons why Sherman's soldiers marching to the sea were fired up is because they ran into some survivors from Andersonville who were grown men who weighed like 85 pounds. And you can see pictures of them online, by the way.
It's a concentration camp.
They wanted some revenge. By the way, the damage caused by Sherman's March to the Sea, not nearly as bad as some people suggest, and a lot of the damage actually committed by stragglers on both sides, bummers. I take that back. Well, Sherman's bummers were basically his soldiers who forage to support the army because it's living off the land. He marches to the sea by cutting his connection with his supply line.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of depredations. They seize a lot of livestock and food, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the actual damage, wanton destruction of property, is done by stragglers, people who are AWOL, both Confederate and Union. And so not an official policy, in other words.
Yeah, and weren't some of the damage done by Confederate soldiers trying to deny, to damage?
A lot of the official damage was against infrastructure, like railroad track,
bridges,
and things like that. In any case, I'm not trying to say this was a children's crusade or whatever.
No,
this wasn't a nice thing. But still, there are also other things on the other side, and not just Andersonville. If you look at something like the Fort Pillow Massacre, where Nathan Bedford Forrest kills all sorts of surrendering Union soldiers because they happen to be black.
Oh.
1864. Or if you look what happens in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, which there's a mini invasion. Everyone, the Gettysburg invasion gets all the attention, but in 1864, Confederate troops came into southern Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
They took the town of Chambersburg, and they basically tried to extort $500,000 in gold from the town.
Oh.
They said, pay us this massive sum or we're going to burn your town down. The town couldn't come up with the money, so they burned it to the ground. These are Confederate soldiers. These are these cavaliers.
Yeah, that's right.
These are these honorable soldiers, right? Or look at how Lee's army behaved the year before. In 1863, when in the Gettysburg campaign, any black person, free or escaped slave, they were mostly free blacks, legally free blacks, anyone that the Army of Northern Virginia got their hands on, they captured and sent back to be a slave in the South.
Even if they've been born in the North, never been to the South.
They didn't care. By the way, that's another little
indication. Back to the South? Yeah.
Yeah. That's another little indication of how this is basically, this is a pro-slavery army. It's not a pro-independence army.
Yeah.
Right. Or if you look at the nature of guerrilla warfare in places like Kansas and Missouri, you've got these sort of bushwhackers. Now, they're not, you can argue that these are not normally Confederate regulars, but these are pro-Confederate forces fighting with a viciousness I cannot describe. And it's where people like the 16-year-old Jesse James gets his start.
Oh, no kidding.
Jesse James, not fundamentally to be understood as a Western outlaw, but as a pro-slavery Southerner in the post-war period looking for revenge.
Wow.
Yeah, because he came from a hardcore pro-slavery era. The famous Northfield Raid where the James Younger gang gets its head handed to it by the locals. That town was picked because the bank there had all the assets of the Reconstruction governor of Mississippi, a guy by the name of Adelbert Ames.
Oh, okay.
It was deliberately targeted. This was basically, these are former Confederate guerrillas
going for the money,
continuing to fight the Civil War. Basically.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
They're not just bank robbers, and they're certainly not. Maybe we should do a show on Jesse James.
Yeah, I'm just writing that down, Buzzkillers.
He was not Robin Hood, let's put it that way.
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. Well, I hope nobody still believes that.
Yeah,
maybe they do.
I hope not, but yeah. He had a good public relations operation in place at the time, by the way. He was way ahead of his time.
Yes, that's right.
He was getting lots of likes online, I think, from the dispossessed.
At Jesse James on Twitter.
Hashtag outlaw on the loose.
Hashtag follow the money. Yes. That's what they were doing. Yeah.
So, and my point is not, I don't want to sort of overcompensate and say that you know, a myth of Northern clean hands and Southern evil.
Right.
But my point is that the Civil War in its latter half gets increasingly vicious on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Look what Phil Sheridan on the Northern side, look what he did in the Shenandoah Valley.
Right.
That was literally scorched earth. They were tired of the Confederate armies foraging on the grain raised in the Shenandoah Valley. So they set fire to it all and destroyed all the buildings.
Yeah.
It was a 20th century war, and the locals had every right to be very, very upset.
Yeah.
But my point is there's all sorts of degradation and war crimes on both sides. Absolutely true. So yeah. I'm here to tell you that all the pillars of a lost cause, they are all mini myths, part of a bigger myth.
It's astounding because usually when we take on a big, big myth like the lost cause, there might be some kernel somewhere.
Right.
And K-E-R-N-A-L, not C-O-L-N-A-L. that might be true of might have started, but in this case, none of it is.
Well, I mean, there are some. For example, if you look at like Confederate performance, you know, Confederate valor on the battlefield.
Well, what you're saying, but you're also saying
Lee's genius. I mean, those are not falsehoods. They're half truths.
Okay, yeah.
Right. I mean, they tell half. They're true as far as they go, but they don't go far enough.
Right. So part of the pillars might have been partially true, but that's not very much to build an entire way of thinking.
Correct.
On.
And that's the way to put it. Right. It's a half truth or a quarter truth in service of a much larger lie.
Wow. Wow.
So, and unfortunately I'll put it this way. I think historians still have a lot of work to do. We're not always the best at outreach. Our ideas don't always percolate the way they ought to. But if you look at the number, even if only pieces of this are still out there, that's still really pernicious and not at all helpful to public debates. So we really still need to do what we do.
So not only, you know, does the Buzzkill Nation need to get bigger, but the Buzzkill foot soldiers out there listening to shows need to go out and, you know, talk to people about these sorts of things because it's one of the continually destructive things about our country.
Absolutely true.
Well, not a very happy note to end the show on with, but we'll get back to you next week.
See you.